go. Yeah, thanks for that, Charlotte, for that lovely meditation. That, too, is also one of my favorite poems. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger. Yeah, and so I guess I came into this community as a kind of stranger. And I didn't know anyone in this room. First person I ever talked to from C3 was Rod. He called me on the phone, or somehow he connected on the phone. He was trying to tell me about this place. He's like, yeah, we're a spiritual community. He's like, okay, so you're like a church? Well, no, we're a spiritual community. And and that conversation, that very first conversation I had with Rod was life-giving and interesting to me. And I thought, how have I not heard of this place? And shortly thereafter, came out and did a, you know, just came as a guest teacher. And then I think I came maybe a month or so later and did it again, and started to find the people I was relating to here and interacting with, encouraging and interesting, and would ask good questions. And the environment was life-giving. And so, I guess I want to say it's been a good 5 years, really. And I'm really grateful. It's like when I left teaching in a traditional church, I thought that was kind of just the end of talking in public. and the end of teaching, really, period. And I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to do. So just to find myself back in a community, and in this particular community, has been really the biggest surprise in my adult life and really just a great gift. So, and thank you for letting me be me, really. And I you let me teach on anything, things that I know like a little bit about, like the Bible, and then and then stuff I know nothing about that I read last week but I thought would be interesting. So and I think probably the thing I'm most grateful for is that, and something I haven't really experienced since I was a high school teacher, you know, teaching in high school is a challenge on multiple levels, but one of the challenges is that you just have to show up every day. And like whatever you said yesterday, you're just, the kid is still there and they're likely to say something back to you. And so it becomes like a conversation, and that's a good thing. And that's what it's been like here. The kinds of things that we're talking about, our values and ideas and what we mean by spirituality and things like that, has been a conversation. And you all have opened up my eyes and I don't know, revealed different landscapes than how I ordinarily think about things and feel about things. And especially for the pre-talk group, and if you stick around for the talk back, thank you. I don't know why I have trouble with that. It's been 5 years. You see that it's a living conversation. And I remember when I first came here, I had this idea that I was going to have this standing lunch time during the week where anyone could come. This is back when we had the other office. And one of the things that I just like to ask people is, how did you end up here? And it was like I got these kind of wild and crazy and unique and different stories for how you ended up in this place. Like, what were the strange intersections in your own life that brought you through these doors? And I realized that this really is quite a diverse and kind of amazing place just by hearing people's stories. So, thank you for letting me share part of my life with you all. And thanks for sharing your life with me over the last few years. So I thought I'd just do something kind of brief. Of course, none of my talks are brief. I'm going to try to be brief because I was told to be brief. So, I'll try to do something brief. I had an idea that since we're in this sort of conversation around questions and have been for the last few months, I started to wonder, well, what questions have been coming up for me just over the last 5 years? Like, what are the questions that won't leave me alone? Not that my questions need to be your questions, but I thought I'd share them. Like, I thought about five questions that have been bothering me. David White has this great line. He says, some questions have no right to go away. And that's how I feel about these. Like, they have no right to go away. They're just to be wrestled with and probably not alone, not in isolation. And you'll hear like some themes in here, obviously stuff I ordinarily talk about, but I thought I'd share like what kind of questions have been working me over the last 5 years. So I'll read you a couple quotations here. First from Einstein and then from Confucius. So this is in your bulletin. The important thing is to not stop questioning. This is from Einstein. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. I might even add that curiosity has its own intelligence, like a kind of mysterious intelligence that kind of leads you somewhere, somewhere that you don't quite know, you know, how to walk or where you're going, something like that. So here's one from Confucius. The man who asks a question is a fool for a minute. The man who does not ask is a fool for life. And yeah, that's one of the things I value here. So anyway, here are just five questions that have been working me. And the first one has to do with consciousness itself. I mean, I could say something like, what is the nature of consciousness? That's certainly a question in the background of just a conversation about consciousness. But I was thinking about this, another quote from Einstein, which I've shared here before, and you probably know it. But he says, no problem can be solved by the same consciousness that created it. And whenever I hear that, I think, yeah, that's right. And then shortly afterwards, I think, yeah, but how do I change my consciousness? He sort of just leaves that. I mean, it seems right. No problem can be solved by the same consciousness that created it. And we have a lot of problems, right? There's a lot of problems just in our own personal lives, in our community, in the broader world. I don't know if you've been watching the news, but there are some big issues and problems and that cloud our place on the planet. And there's something that strikes me as profoundly true about what Einstein is saying here. All right, we generated a lot of our own problems, but what we need is a shift in consciousness to wrestle with them. So it's one of the questions that has no right to go away, at least for me. And so here are some follow-up questions like, well, what sort of consciousness is needed or is being called forth that we can and sort of must live into? And maybe more simple, how can we be the kind of place that keeps growing? You know, I mean, just in terms of our awareness, our own consciousness, how we view the world, can we be the kind of place that keeps growing? I think that's always a temptation for any community that says, okay, this is the community, and here are the even our boundaries are a bit loose here, but we have boundaries, we have a container here, and so just how do we keep growing? And you might even ask that just like on the personal level, like in your involvement here. How do I keep growing? How does my own consciousness expand or shift or grow? Has that been happening? You know, that would be a good question for me over the last 5 years. Has my own consciousness, my own awareness grown over the last 5 years? Has yours? Or is it getting smaller? Which is sort of the pull of any group. Let's keep the things small and contained. And okay. Otherwise, we'll believe our own PR a little too much, right? We'll believe in our own PR. So, okay, here's question number two. First question was, how do we continue to grow, and how does our own consciousness shift and grow? All right, here's number two. Are we better off being non-religious? Okay, now I have to admit, this is a personal question for me. It's been bothering me. Are we better off being non-religious? And if you would have asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, yes. We're better off being non-religious, that religion is the problem, you know, too much dogma and doctrine and constraint. And then you have the whole history of religions and religious institutions. But personally, this question will not leave me alone. It keeps bothering me. And partly that I've been bothered by Jung. And as you know, I'm always quoting from Jung, like, what is this guy's problem? Does he read anything else? I promise you, I do read other things, but generally they're people who are commenting on Jung. So one of the things that Jung posited is that we have a religious instinct. Now think about that for a moment, a religious instinct. And he means instinct on the limbic level, way down there, as part of our evolutionary makeup. Now, you could say, I think he's wrong. We don't have a religious instinct. But if he's right, and you go around saying, I'm not religious, then you've got a problem. Because can you deny an instinct? Now, you can try, but what happens is it's going to leak out sideways. You know that if you just think about any of the other instincts, correct? So I think this is such a troubling and interesting question for the 21st century. What about the religious instinct? And right now, let's just define it something very simply as that impulse, that deep impulse toward ultimate meaning. That's the way I would define it just presently. That impulse, that something in us that wants to aim toward something that's ultimately true in the world, what's ultimately real. And I'd say, yeah, the religious instinct is alive and well in my view. And so that means how we orient in the world is a little like what we call a religion, a set of boundaries, a set of values even, just a way of orienting. And so this is a question that I'm not trying to answer right now, but I'm just trying to sit with. Are we better off being non-religious? And one of the things I've noticed is that, and you can disagree, and I'd love to know if you would disagree, not right this second, please. But it seems like politics is the new religion. So you can say, I'm not religious, I don't believe in any of that religious dogma, but we hold on to political ideologies like a religious dogma, fiercely. And okay, I'm not here to point the finger right this moment, but where is that coming from? I'm just suggesting, I'm wondering if in part it comes from that religious impulse. What is ultimately true in the world? So maybe it's important to pay attention to those impulses and leanings. Otherwise, I think one of the great advantages of a quote religious perspective is that it puts us into a conversation with something greater than our own individual small self. It says there's something larger here. There's something larger here. And I think that's important. Otherwise, what ends up happening? I don't know. We bow down at the altar of things like I think and I feel, or we bow down at the altar of our own phone, which just mirrors back to us what we already know. You know, so it keeps us small. And I think, anyway, I think there's an interesting question that at least won't leave me alone around the question of religion. Which brings me to question number three. Does the question of God still matter? Does the question of God still matter? Yeah, and you can see that I'm always dancing with this question anyway. What have you been up to for the last 5 years? I've been dancing with this question, really. Does it matter? And how does it matter? And why does it matter? So in my view, the answer to this question is yes. The question of God does still matter in some way, and maybe now more than ever. Jung, my hero, I guess, had carved across the lintel of his own doorpost, called or not, God will be present. You know, so every time he went in and out of the house, he just, you know, this, you know, pulled him in some way. Called or not, God will be present. And of course, you're going to want to say, what do you mean by God? And I'll say, good question, and it's worth wrestling with. What do we mean? What did we mean? What did our ancestors mean? What do you mean? If you say you don't believe in God, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Are we talking about, you know, an abstract idea, an animating spirit, God as process, a being, a truth, reality with a capital R? What do you mean by God? And how might our own way of framing the divine grow instead of small? Like I heard a comedian say the other day, he doesn't believe in an old man in the sky. And I thought, nobody does at this point, really. Really? An old man in the sky with a beard. That's it. I don't believe in that God. Okay, welcome to the 21st century. Nobody really does. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have images. You know, one way of framing it is that instinct, that impulse is like in the old world, well, still, it still exists. You had a stamp, and into that stamp, you would pour metal, and then you'd press on that metal, and that would come a coin. You familiar with this? That's where the word archetype comes from. So an archetype is a pattern, and into it pours the individual metal, and that stamp, that face of the coin, can look different in different parts of the world. Sometimes that's how I think about the divine. All right, maybe it's like an archetype. It's like a pattern that's back there somewhere. And all of our individual characteristics, even like the old man in the sky, is an image. But the image is not the important thing. Maybe there's something beyond that. So these are questions that I'm wrestling with that won't leave me alone. And maybe one more PS. I've been into reading a bit of the mystics. I'm not an expert on the mystics. And one of them I read this year, St. John of the Cross, has something interesting. He says something kind of terrible and awesome at the same time. He says, every once in a while, God decides to wean us from God. Wean us from our own images of the divine. What we've either rejected or accepted. He's like, that's the mysterious. That's what he called the dark night, being weaned from God. And sometimes I wonder if we're in that kind of place, and maybe culturally we're being weaned from these kind of like caricatures around what's ultimately true. So that's question three. Does the question of God still matter? All right, question number four. I really hope the answer to this one is yes. Is there something beyond the right-left divide? I mean, please. I really want there to be something beyond the right-left divide. And I'm not saying that right and left are meaningless. Or that they're just like, what would you call it, social constructs that are just, you know, illusions. No, I think there is something going on in the right and the left, and something worth looking at. But please, is there anything beyond that? Is there anything beyond that kind of division? In other words, I'm thinking of Ken Wilber, who says that as you're growing up, really in terms of consciousness, there's the possibility of transcending and including. You've probably heard me or others use that phrase, transcend and include, transcend and include. And I think, does that apply to politics? Because I just prefer exclude and exclude, or transcend and ignore. but transcend and include, like, so maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's more like include and transcend. So these are things that are bothering me about the fierce divisions right now. And maybe of the questions that I've outlined right here, maybe it's the most practical one. Is there something beyond the right-left divide? It's like, that's a very practical question. How do you know it's a practical question? Because Thanksgiving is coming and you're probably going to eat with people on the other side, you know? So it's relevant, I think, in that sense. And over the last 5 years, I've lost my taste a little bit for scapegoating and blaming and shaming. I'm trying to come out of that myself, but I've lost my taste for the way that both sides do that to one another. Scapegoat, blame, and shame. Scapegoat, blame, shame. Shame, shame, shame. And we just do this to one another, and it seems like it makes the cultural atmosphere more toxic. And I think, oh, please, maybe there's some other path. You know, and there's so many ironies, and I think part of, and we've done this a little bit at C3 as we've been talking about the human shadow, but part of the invitation is to take a look at your own shadow as much as possible, like your own contradictions and paradoxes and ironies. In the last election, I started to have a little bit of a freak out, and I just decided, because I'd never done it before, to list every single issue out on a piece of paper and actually write out where I stood on those individual issues. I'd never done that before. I was a little alarmed, you know? I didn't fit so neatly. I sounded like a moderate some of the time. I was like, what? You know, I used to have, you know, a Grateful Dead shirt. I'm not a moderate, you know? And so, okay, my own contradictions and ironies, and just trying to face up to these things, and I think it's important, and maybe that kind of like sort of internal examination can lead us out of this right-left hatred is really what it's becoming. It's like, what's that line in the Bible? No one is righteous, no, not one, you know? Yeah, okay, so I'm not that righteous. Definitely not. Okay. Maybe I'll just add a couple things here. One of the things that we've been talking a bit about in terms of big picture things, is the latest advances in science, in brain science, in personality, in human personality, in the influence of the social matrix we find ourselves in. I think we're coming to see more and more that all of us, all human beings, are a combination of like DNA and personality and education and social influence and wounds and hangups and traumas and gifts and experience. We're a mixture of all these things. And is it possible to include and transcend those things? Especially when you're thinking about someone that you might not agree with. Aren't they just a complex human being? A combination of personality and social influence and education and wounds and traumas and gifts and short-sighted at times. So I don't know. I mean, these are just things that trouble me. Is there something beyond that? Now, the question I think that also is important is if what I'm saying is true, that we're sort of like an amalgam in a way, the if we only treat the other as an enemy, I think it continues to limit our consciousness. But at the same time, it's important to say we might have differences of opinion. We might have differences of values. We might disagree on various things. I don't think it's the same thing as just saying I have to keep everything at arm's length, either as the enemy, or I have to say that, well, there's no such thing as truth, and your truth is your truth, and my truth is my truth. I don't think either of those two extremes are helping in this conversation. Have I made some sense? Okay, here's the final question. What do we mean by inclusive? You know, what do we mean by inclusive? And actually, I don't know. I mean, I know it to a certain extent. I actually know it as a kind of impulse, first of all. Like, I want to include more. And I want more of what's true and what's real to come in, we could say. But I think it is worth wrestling with. I mean, after all, we call ourselves an inclusive spiritual community. Well, what do we mean? And what else might be asked of us at this point in our story? And it's funny because I think even in 5 years, the word inclusive has now become one of the words that has entered the culture wars, really. It's now part of the culture wars. And as I was thinking about this question, and I don't really have a good answer, by the way. It's not like I'm going to wrap things up. I'm just going to say I think it's worth wrestling with. And but I looked up the etymology of the word, and I thought that was like kind of ironic. See if you can feel the tension here. So to include, technically, in Latin, means to shut in. Huh. Or here's a lighter way of putting it. That's the direct meaning, to shut in. Here's a lighter way of putting it. Hold on, I've got to find it. To bring something within the walls. To bring something within the walls. That's what being inclusive is. That's interesting because that says, okay, we do have walls. We do have boundaries here. Like we do have, and even if you think about our values, we're trying to state the fence that goes around, that holds us in some way. Does it make sense? And to be inclusive is to bring more into the fence. That means it's always going to be a challenge. Always. Because once you bring something in, then you're dealing with a different environment, a different landscape. It changes the terrain as we bring in more perspectives and ideas and stories and human beings and those who have been marginalized and those who have been on the top. You know, what does that mean now? What does it mean to be inclusive? And maybe I just want to end with maybe a question that I think is related to being inclusive, and it's very simple. And is, what is it like to be you? What is it like to be you? I hope we're that kind of community, that if you're sitting here, you have friends and strangers, powerful strangers, who want to know, what is it like to be you? And to ask that kind of question is to bring people over the fence, so to speak, to bring them in some way and say, I'd like to know what it's like to be you. And in turn, I'll tell you what it's like to be me. And there's something about that I think that is so simple, and also I think so necessary as we think about the changing nature of culture and spirituality and communities like this. So really, I feel like I did a really awesome job of keeping things short. So just would like to congratulate myself, and I want to thank you for listening, and thank you for letting me be me, and for asking me what it's like to be me, and I hope I'll do the same in turn. So thanks for listening.